That man from the government didn't say Patty did bad. All I heard she do was let a tired man sleep where nobody else wanted to sleep and gave him food that came from nobody's mouth. And I want you to stop interfering in something that's none of your business.
The earth-colored yolks of Ruth's eyes rose to their highest point, leaving a splash of whiteness below.
This here is the Lord's business, Mr. Bergen, and I'm trying to do the work he set out for me.
Her hands were clasped, and her eyes stayed heavenward. After a moment, she nodded as though she understood her silent instructions.
God is our refuge and strength, and a help in troubles. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth be removed and the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Be still, and know that I am God.
Ruth, get yourself out of here.
Listen to the law speaking to you, Mr. Bergen.
Couldn't Ruth see she was wasting her time? Leave him alone. He doesn't understand, I whispered.
God Almighty is crying out to you to bring forth your humanity. He wants you to quit your tormenting and put your faith in him.
My father threw Ruth a look that could have split rock.
And now I'm telling you. You've pushed me past my endurance. I think a lot of Patty's meanness is your doing. This family doesn't need you anymore.
He took out his wallet and threw a $5 bill and 3 ones onto the bed. One of the singles rested for a moment at the side of the bed before fluttering to the floor. Neither Ruth nor my father made any effort to pick it up.
Now, I'm paying you for the week, but I don't want you here 1 second longer. Get your things and get out, now. Lord knows I needs this job, Mr. Bergen. Lord knows I needs the money, but...
Ruth's arm tightened around me.
This child needs me even more than I needs the work. Truth is, she does.
Don't send Ruth away. Please don't do it. My arms couldn't complete the circle around her waist. If you never in your life do another thing for me, don't send her away. She's all I have left.
Take the money, Ruth,
said my father in a voice marked by sudden calmness.
And then you tell those fat legs of yours to take you out of here.
Chapter 18. Pierce walked to the door of my room without entering.
All settled, Mr. Bergen. We're taking the girl into Memphis.
Then he gave me a nod.
Better pack a few things. How long will she be gone?
I don't know, sir. She'd better take a few changes.
I got the smallest of the 3 suitcases out of the closet and began putting in some clothes like a robot who feels nothing. I wasn't even conscious anymore of wanting anything except maybe to be left alone, and I wasn't even strong on that. Living was too big a deal, and dying too much trouble. When I snapped the case closed, the agent asked,
"Ready to go?"
"Yes." My father was shouting into the phone,
"Well, get Mr. Kishner out of conference. This is an emergency. Let the hardwood dealers of America wait."
No, it's not about my business. I guess I ought to know what kind of lawyer I need.
Less than an hour? Have Mr. Kishner call me back collect at number 255 Jenkinsville, Arkansas. Got that? Number 255.
We're ready, Mr. Bergen, said Pierce.
I can't leave. I want to be here when the lawyer calls.
No problem. It's only a couple of blocks to our car.
McPhee, get the suitcase, will you?
As I walked past my father, I said, Goodbye. But maybe he didn't hear. At any rate, he didn't answer. The sidewalk was too narrow for three, so Pierce and McPhee walked a few steps behind me. Across the street, Freddie Dowd looked up from his worm diggings.
Where are you going? Someplace?
Memphis.
Boy, oh boy, he said, letting out his widest grin. I sure wish I was you.
I laughed inside. There are better wishes to wish for, Freddie. As we came close to my father's store, I saw people milling in front. Too many people for a weekday, unless today is Dollar Day. Suddenly, the FBI men were walking at my side.
Stay close to me, whispered Pierce.
There were 10. More than that, at least 15 people, and all with fixed faces. They know about me. How could they have found out so soon? Then I spotted Jenkinsville's leading gossip merchant, Mary Wren, holding on to the arm of Reverend Ben's wife. The agents maneuvered me away from the sidewalk and into the center of Main Street. The crowd followed. A glob of liquid hit me in the back of the neck, and when I saw what my hand had wiped away, I gagged. Suddenly a woman's voice called,
Nazi! Nazi!
Other voices joined in. A man's voice, one that I had heard before, shouted,
Jew Nazi! Jew Nazi! Jew Nazi!
When we reached the car, the mob blocked the doors.
You people are obstructing justice, said Pierce. Please move back.
Jew Nazi lover! Screamed the minister's wife.
Tires screeched to a stop. A car door opened, and Sheriff Caldwell shouted,
Get away from that car! What's the matter with you folks, anyway?
People slowly moved away from the car, crowding into a huddle on the sidewalk. Sheriff Caldwell opened the back door of the car for me, and then, whipping out a small black Bible from his shirt pocket, he pressed it into my hand.
Times when I was down, this helped lift me up. God bless you.
Thanks, I said, feeling the tears stinging at my eyes. McPhee drove in second gear all the way down Main Street before taking a right turn onto Highway 64. As we passed McDonald's Dairy, I looked down the long dirt road leading to the prison camp. But I knew I wasn't going to find him there, or any other place on God's earth. I was already awake when the phone first rang downstairs at 7:45. By 9, there had already been 3 or 4 incoming calls. I wondered if they concerned me. At 9:30, I knew I couldn't put it off any longer. I would go downstairs and face my grandparents. Last night it was pretty late when the agents brought me here, and Grandmother Freed said that I looked very tired and she took me straight to bed. This morning, though, it might be different. She might get around now to the questions she hadn't asked.
I saw her at the kitchen table, stirring a cup of coffee with one hand and holding the phone with the other.
You sure about Harry selling the store?
Things blow over. People forget.
Pearl, I'll talk to Papa.
Didn't I say I would?
If Harry had been maybe a little nice to us all these years, then I know Papa would say sure. Now I don't know.
My grandmother looked up as I entered the kitchen.
Pearl, I have to go now. Patty just woke up.
Yes, Pearl, I'll talk.
I'll talk.
Tonight, after supper.
Goodbye.
My father has to sell the store?
Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. Who knows? My daughter always makes a gunsa tzimmis out of everything.
And my father wants to go to work for grandfather?
Your mother wants it. Only Gott in Himmel knows what your daddy wants.
Grandmother brought me a perfectly oval omelet.
I'm sorry to cause you all this trouble, I said.
Trouble? An omelet is trouble?
Well, that and having to stay up to let me in last night.
It's nice having you,
she said, patting my cheek.
Even if it's because of this mishmash.
Mishmash?
What else? Does a person have to ask for credentials before they can give food to a hungry man? Are you responsible because you gave nourishment to a bad man? The whole business is a mishigos.
I'm glad you're not angry with me.
What is there to be angry about? I have messages for you. I'm going to drive you to Lawyer Kishner's office at 10:45, and he's going to take you himself to the FBI. Also, a friend called.
She began searching through a pad of paper.
I wrote it down myself. Here. It's a Miss Charlene Madley. She's coming by tonight to see you.
Mostly, I told the FBI everything they wanted to know, and I told it about a dozen times to 4 different agents. One question they seemed keen on asking was if anybody else knew. Sometimes they'd just ask,
"Who else knew?"
or,
"Why are you taking all the blame?"
Things like that. But always I gave the same answer. Nobody else knew. It was only me. It was after 4 in the afternoon when the boss agent, Mr. Wilhelm, told one of the younger agents to drive me back to my grandmother's.
I don't believe we'll be needing you any more, Patty. But you'd better stay here in Memphis for a while. Things are unsettled in Jenkinsville.
Unsettled?
Well, I understand your parents are being harassed.
How?
Telephone calls, store window broken, things like that.
Why would they bother them? Can't you tell people that they had nothing to do with it? They didn't even know. Mr. Wilhelm scratched his forehead like he was trying to come up with an answer for me.
When people's emotions are involved, they don't want to listen.
At 8 o'clock, my grandmother opened the door for Charlene as I stood at the top of the stairs, waiting for my trembling to subside. Would she hate me? It was kind of you to let me come tonight, Mrs. Freed. If there was any hate in Charlene's voice, I couldn't catch it.
Our pleasure, Miss
Madley. Charlene Madley.
Yes, well, Miss Madley. Patty needs all her friends now. You saw the evening paper.
Oh, yes. I read them as well as write for them.
You write? For newspapers? You told me you were a friend of Patty's. Friends we need, reporters we don't.
Believe me, Mrs. Freed, I am a friend. When we met during the summer, Patty told me that her grandparents lived in Hyde Park. Also, I came here tonight to bring you encouraging news. As I walked down the stairs, Charlene gave me a real smile. Still my friend. My grandfather pulled out a dining room chair for Charlene.
My wife makes the best strudel in the world. Wait till you taste.
He smacked his lips. Charlene ate a forkful. You know, Mrs. Freed, I think your husband is right. You do make the world's best strudel. It's wonderful, I said. I remember reading somewhere that kissing doesn't last, but cookery does. My grandfather jumped up from the host's chair to give grandmother a noisy kiss on her cheek.
Does that answer your question, young lady? Sam.
We all laughed, then abruptly turned to Charlene as if hoping she might give us something of substance to laugh about. I talked today to Charles Hammett, said Charlene.
He's the editor of the Commercial Appeal?
Asked Grandfather. He's our publisher. Well, Mr. Hammett had lunch with a high official from the Justice Department, which would be the agency responsible for initiating legal actions in such cases as Patty's. The feeling is that the government would be very reluctant to prosecute a 12-year-old under the Treason Act. Also, he mentioned that our allies would consider us barbaric if we did such a thing. Grandfather clapped his hands.
Thank God. I knew this American government was 100% okay. After all, what did my granddaughter do that's so terrible? She's only 12, so she didn't act wisely, okay. But she meant good. You have to admit that. And do you think for one minute that fellow, Oliver Shalom, told Patty that he was an escaped prisoner? Also, one other point. Excuse me for bringing this up, Miss Madley. I recognize that you aren't of our faith, but do you think that if we were Protestants, there would be all this hullabaloo?
I'm certain there wouldn't, Mr. Freed. There's no question that this gave some people an excuse to parade their anti-Semitism. But all the interest isn't anti-Semitic. Some people may find love and brotherhood in the story. The Memphis Bureau of United Press sent it over the international wires, which means that tonight people throughout the world will be reading about how a Jewish girl befriended a German boy.
I pray to God, said Grandmother, that when they read about Patty, they'll feel a little closer to their brothers, no matter what faith or nationality. I'm just glad it's over, said Grandfather.
Charlene looked confused. I'm sorry if I implied that all charges against Patty will be dropped. I meant only the serious charges of treason. The man from the Justice Department felt that if there was a public outcry, the state of Arkansas might wish to prosecute Patty on a lesser charge. But I'm not guilty of a lesser charge. They can call it treason, but they can't call it anything else. At best, Patty, all charges will be dropped, said Charlene. But if the Arkansas politicians are pushed to move against you, they could easily get you on, say, a delinquency charge. In that way, the federal government is off the hook, and people will still feel that justice has been served. Grandmother clasped her hand to her heart.
You don't think? It's not possible that they would send my granddaughter to jail.
It's only the slightest of possibilities, said Charlene slowly, as though she were choosing her words with inordinate care. But there does still exist the chance that Patty might be sent to reform school.
Chapter 19.
O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go.
The music from the car radio turned to static.
Too far from Jonesboro to get much reception, said Mr. Calvin Grimes.
I guess so.
Well, he said, snapping the radio off, reckon that's it.
Yes, sir, guess it is, I answered, trying to keep up my end of the conversation. The sky was purply, deepening even as I watched, warning of the approach of darkness and maybe even of snow. Along the highway, rows of never-been-painted tenant shacks glowed with the softness of kerosene lamps. Their windows without curtains gave quick exposures of tenant families, mostly colored, sitting around the supper table. Then with sudden speed, Mr. Grimes swerved from the right to the left-hand lane to pass a pokey tractor.
"Fellers should know enough," he said. "To have his lights on this time of day, wouldn't you think? Slow-moving vehicle like that?"
"Yes, sir, he sure should," I said. As the road turned off to the left, there was a definite rise from the flatness of the Delta lands. Beginning in me was a matching feeling of ascent. "Where have you been for such a long time, Hope? Remember the last time you came paying me a visit? Wait 6 years, you told me. Only 6 years and I would have outside beauty, more even than my mother's, while inside I would grow beautiful like Ruth. And then I would find Anton again, and he would love me for everything I was, everything I had become." Suddenly a chuckle started up in me, and then a second and a third. Without moving my eyes from the side window, I could tell Mr. Grimes had turned to look at me.
"Girl, if you've got yourself a funny, why don't you share it?"
No, sir. I don't actually know any jokes or anything like that. It was just that... Well... I was thinking of a friend of mine whom I liked being with so much because he could always make things fun. You know what I mean?
Reckon I do,
Mr. Grimes measured out his words.
Them kind of folks always nice to have around.
Not just big things, I explained, because for some reason I really wanted him to understand. But little things, too. Things that lots of folks wouldn't even find amusing.
Girl, that's one of the Lord's blessings. Laughter and them that makes it. Like he gives it to some folks to be strong, others to be rich. Now, to me he gave a fine wife and 4 good boys. Them's blessings, girl. Everybody's got to find the Lord's bounty and give thanks. You know your blessings? You counted 'em, laid 'em aside, and said your thanks?
I thought of Ruth, grandmother, and grandfather. I thought of the frizzle that had finally grown out of my hair. And then I thought of him. And I wondered if a blessing is still a blessing if it lasts for only a little while. Then, with my eyes quite open, Anton's face came through. I closed my eyes to blot out all possible distractions. He was smiling that smile. I'd seen it before when he said to me, "Remember, PB, remember when..." But I didn't hear the rest of his words. I was just too filled up with feelings of pleasure and privilege to think that in those short days together we had begun making memories.
"You getting hungry?"
Mr. Grimes's dry voice popped my bubble of reverie.
"There's a restaurant down the road just past Lambert. We could stop there for hamburgers, 'cause I'm not in a million years gonna make Bolton till after 10 o'clock. I just don't know whether one of them matrons would save you a bite of supper. I wouldn't bet my last nickel on it, tell you that for sure."
In the distance, a large red neon sign blinked. "Shanley's Golf Station. Good food, good gas." Even a car length away from Shanley's front door, the smell of things fried, hamburgers, potatoes, and onions, was pretty powerful. At the back of the restaurant, a fancy jukebox changed from red to purple to blue as it blared forth,
"Shuffle on down to Memphis town, shuffle on down to Memphis town. Ain't got no money, but I'll show you around."
I followed Mr. Grimes to the only empty booth, empty of people, but not of their dishes. Ashes and cigarette butts filled the glass ashtray to capacity. Our waitress, who was about 16, and I guess you'd call her pretty, wore beaded Indian moccasins but no stockings over her hairy legs. She dropped a menu wrapped in a cellophane folder on the table and left without bothering to clean up the mess. With the back of his arm, Mr. Grimes swept the dirty dishes to the edge of the table.
"I like it clean and neat when I eat," he said. "Seems like ever since the war, waitresses been going from bad to worse."
As he shook his head, I noticed deep lines which ran like chicken wire from the corners of his eyes, clean out to his hairline. Mr. Grimes was far away from being young, and, judging from the leanness of his body, he'd never been especially strong. After we had eaten our hamburgers and French fries and drunk down our coffee, Mr. Grimes waved to the waitress.
"What kind of pie you got?"
She gave her hair, which was the color of brown wrapping paper, a good scratching. "We're all out of apple." Nodding in the direction of the counter, she said, "Gave that feller the last piece."
"What kind have you got left?"
asked Mr. Grimes, not bothering to keep the irritation out of his voice. "About the only thing I know we got is some sugar doughnuts left over from the morning and some lemon meringue pie."
"I'll take a piece of that meringue," he said, and he looked over at me. "You want a piece, too?"
Behind the counter, a penciled sign read, "All pies, 12 cents. "Well, no, thank you. I guess I don't care for any pie today."
"Better get some," encouraged Mr. Grimes. "This might be your last decent meal for a while."
When I laid my fork down, the pie plate had only a few pinpoint-sized crumbs left on it. I wanted to send my fork after those, too, but didn't want Mr. Grimes to think I was still a little hungry. I felt his eyes upon me and looked up.
"Oh, by the way," he said, "I don't think you ought to go mentioning to anybody that we stopped off for a bite of supper, 'cause, just strictly speaking, I ain't supposed to stop nowhere with no prisoner."
Prisoner? Me? The judge never once used that word. "I hereby sentence Patricia Ann Bergen to be committed to the Arkansas Reformatory for Girls at Bolton, Arkansas, for a period of not more than 6 months nor less than 4 months."
But if Mr. Grimes calls me a prisoner, I guess he ought to know. Funny, the word has no sting. But then nothing has much sting anymore. He rubbed his fist back and forth across his chin.
So we'll just keep this between you and me, okay?
I didn't want him fearing for his job on my account. Mr. Grimes, it was sure nice of you to stop so I could have something to eat, and I will never say anything to anybody. If I got you in trouble, pow, God should strike me down dead. His smile showed a vacancy between two front teeth.
Lord, girl, I sure don't want nothing like that happening to you.
I felt myself smiling back. He was really quite nice. The whole thing is, and I thought about it quite a lot, it's not true what they said about me. In court, they called me a person of no loyalties, a traitor. But it just couldn't be true, 'cause it was my loyalties that got me in trouble in the first place. You know what I mean? He nodded.
I read about it in the papers, how you helped out that German boy.
I was grateful he called him a boy, better than the others calling him Nazi or spy. I wanted to help him because he wasn't a Nazi or a spy, and he wasn't even mean. Anton was the kindest, smartest man I've ever known. I wanted to tell that to the judge so he'd understand why I had to hide him, why I had to help him stay free. But Mr. Kishner just kept shaking his head no. Mr. Grimes was looking at me as though Anton couldn't be all those things I said he was. Why did I have to go spouting off to him? What made me think he would understand when nobody else could? Don't you think, I asked, hearing the anger in my voice, that a German can be good?
Oh, I reckon on St. Peter opening up them pearly gates for some Germans, he said. Now, there ain't no need to go getting your dander up just 'cause I don't understand who's this Mr. Kishner.
I'm sorry. He's the man, the lawyer, my father hired to tell my side of the story in court. Only thing is, he kept saying that the really important things were not pertinent to the case.
Them lawyers are tricky fellers, all right, said Mr. Grimes. One time, oh, this was 2 or 3 years ago, I was taking a feller name of Cranston Hollis to the Cummins prison farm.
He waved his empty coffee cup in the air, and Miss Beaded Moccasins filled both of our cups from a steaming pot.
Well, Mr. Cranston Hollis, he was one big man, president of a state savings bank in North Little Rock. Only thing was, when the bank examiner came to look at the ledger, he found that Mr. Hollis's bank was shy $185,000, and that ain't even counting the change.
I said, that's a lot.
Ooh-wee, I'll say it is. More money than I'll make in all my working lifetime. Well, this Mr. Hollis, he was one smart man. Told me 8 people other than him worked in that bank. 6 of them had more opportunity than he did to take the money. But his lawyer didn't even entertain the notion that he was defending an innocent man. So Mr. Hollis's advice to anyone who has to go up before the bar of justice is to beware of at least 2 people. The lawyer the state hires to convict you, and the lawyer you hire to defend yourself.
It was easier for me to agree with poor Mr. Cranston Hollis now than before my experience with Mr. Kishner. But it wasn't exactly his fault. I mean, actually, he didn't want to take my case in the first place.
My father had especially wanted Mr. Kishner because he was known as a really big Memphis lawyer, and I know for a fact how proud the Beth Zion Synagogue is that he is one of them. When my father first phoned him, Mr. Kishner said that it wasn't the kind of thing he wanted to get involved in, and besides, since the case would be tried in the Arkansas courts, it would be much better to hire a local, non-Jewish attorney. Somebody who knew all the local judges and wouldn't be afraid to speak out. After Mr. Kishner refused to take my case, my father placed another long-distance call to Memphis. This time it was to Morris Frank, president of Beth Zion, who I think my father had met before. Mr. Frank said that he had known Harold Kishner for more than 30 years, and if anybody could get him to take the case, he could. And he did. On the very next day, Mr. Kishner's thin and unsmiling secretary led me into an office of dark wood, real leather chairs, and an oriental rug of such fire and density that it must have taken 100 weavers all their lifetimes to complete. A window behind the great man gave a fine view of the Memphis skyline. The lawyer sighed into the receiver. "Leo, why can't you keep in mind that we're treating it as a tax preference item?" When he finally placed the receiver on the hook, he nodded at me without smiling. I nodded back while forcing a smile. He got up from his chair. I edged forward in mine. Finally, he said he was my lawyer, hired to be, and that he was going to see if he could help me. He asked me to tell my story just as it happened, and as I did, he scribbled notes on a long yellow pad. Every so often, he would interrupt to ask a question or clarify a point. A couple of times, and in slightly different ways, he asked if I were afraid of Anton, afraid that harm might come to either me or my family if I failed to obey. Mr. Kishner's lips thinned when I shook my head. I was never afraid. Then he tried to get me to say I was too young to understand that Anton was an escaped prisoner. How could I have not understood that? I wanted to tell him that I had some pride left and that they could accuse me of being a traitor, but not of being stupid. But I kept quiet. Finally, Mr. Kishner replaced his fountain pen in his onyx desk set and rose, looking me over closely for the first time, and I knew that he would speak.
"Young lady, you have embarrassed Jews everywhere. Because your loyalty is questionable, then every Jew's loyalty is in question."
He sighed before adding,
"I just wanted you to know."
Outside Shanley's restaurant, the air came up sharp and clean.
"Cold enough for you?"
asked Mr. Grimes. "Oh, I don't mind," I said. A vision of snow on distant mountaintops came to me, and I was close to asking if there were mountains at Bolton, but fear that he would say there was only flat land kept the question unasked. With the end of Anton, hope had taken to its sickbed, if not its deathbed. I found a small bit of courage within, not enough for mountains, but maybe for a little snow. I decided to squander it. "Any chance we might get snow for Christmas?" Mr. Grimes looked to the right and then the left, shifted into second, and entered the 2-lane highway before speaking.
"Weatherman on the radio said the Carolinas might get some. but I ain't never heard of Snow taking no geography lessons. Back in 38 or 39, 38 it was, we got almost an inch of snow for Christmas.
I'd like that to happen again, I said as I brought my shoeless feet up beside me on the car seat. My head found a resting place in the bow of my arm. I felt myself going down, down to sleep. Against my arm, tapping.
Wake up, girl! We're almost there!
What? I stifled my yawn inside the crook of my elbow.
We're coming into Bolton. Thought you'd like to see it. The school's east of town.
Oh, I said, conscious of feeling nothing but sleepy. Then, spanning the width of the street, strings of Christmas lights, red and blue, green and yellow. A lighted movie marquee announced The Five Sullivans and Christmas Cartoons. I saw that movie, I said, coming alive. All about five brothers, sailors on this ship that was sunk. Saddest thing I've ever seen. Try to see that movie if you get the chance.
Nope, answered Mr. Grimes. Don't have to spend my money for sadness. Plenty of that to be had for free.
Mr. Grimes followed the road through town, past two blocks of houses, a gas station, and then open land. Headlights picked up a black iron fence, and as the car swung through open gates, I saw a sign with the Arkansas State Seal. It read, "The Jasper E. Conrad, Arkansas Reformatory for Girls, Bolton, Arkansas." The lights were on in the three-story building. In the darkness, it looked no different from any other three-story brick. No, there was something different. The windows were covered, all covered with diamond-shaped, heavy wire screening. At the Memphis Zoo, they use the same kind of screening for the animals. Chapter 20. My eyes opened. I measured the bleakness of the morning against the painted grayness of the walls and estimated the time to be 6:30. Ever since I had been here, and today marked the 32nd morning, there had been this new ability of mine to awaken, fully awake, without stretching or yawning. Part of it was knowing that this 30 minutes before the wake-up bell was the only time that belonged to me. All right, get to it, I told myself. This is finally going to be the morning when things come to me, my plans for a lifetime. I gave myself the usual instructions. Try new roads. Check out all byways. Explore every possibility. But my mind hadn't even finished its pep talk when the familiar vision intruded. Go away, I said out loud. I have to be practical. I couldn't risk everything on such a slim hope. It didn't make sense. Think practical. Think about living in Memphis with grandmother and grandfather. My father wouldn't hear of it. Didn't he tell the FBI that they had no right to take me to grandma's that evening after they had finished questioning me? Then think about going away to school, to some private place in New England where nobody would know me. My mother wouldn't let me. Even before the scandal, I clipped an ad from the back pages of the Ladies' Home Journal showing a girl about my age smiling at her horse, and underneath the picture it read, Briarcliff, an experience in living.
My mother only glanced at the ad before starting to laugh.
"Where do you dream up such ideas?" she demanded. "Are you such a fancy girl you need such a fancy school?"
No possibility there. None at all. "Well, I've heard about people working their way through school, and there are things I can do. I could take care of the horses. I'd love that. Then even if that job were filled, there are other things. Cooks need helpers, or maybe I could use the work experience that I'm getting here." As I brought my hands from beneath the blanket, bleach attacked my nostrils. That smell may have been part of my imagination, but my red, chapped hands weren't. "No, I don't want to work in anybody's laundry anywhere anymore."
The vision was still there waiting for me, soft and appealing. I let it in. "It's 6 years from now. I'm 18. The war is over. With my $1,000 war bond, I have money enough to take a train to New York and from there a ship to Germany. Another train ride and I'm in Göttingen. At the train station, I change into my prettiest dress before dialing the number. No, not at the station. Better at a hotel. A woman answers and I ask, "Mrs. Riker?" "This is Mrs. Riker," says the voice in elegant English. "Mrs. Riker," I say slowly, "I'm an American. My name is Patricia Bergen. I knew your son, Anton." There is only silence, so I stumble on. "We were friends back when he was a prisoner of war in America."
"You knew Anton?"
she asks, her voice hollow like it was traveling over great distance or great sorrow. I breathe in deeply before answering. "Yes, I knew Anton. We were friends. I tried to help him."
"You tried to help him? Where are you?" asks Mrs. Riker, sounding suddenly energized.
I tell her that I'm right here in Göttingen, and she asks, "Could you possibly have dinner with us tonight? And of course any traveling companions you have would be most welcome." "Well, I don't actually have any traveling companions," I say.
"Then you must stay with us," she replies. "We have a large house. We could make you most comfortable."
My heart floated up like a helium balloon until the ringing of the wake-up bell punctured it. I cried out against the intrusion, wondering if there weren't some way to hold on to the vision. It seemed unfair. I had lost my chance to become a member of the family.
"Hey, Nats, you gonna get up? Scrambled egg day."
I pulled the covers down to look directly into the Raggedy Ann eyes of my roommate, Mavis McCall.
"I'm getting up,"
I said, wiggling my feet to give the impression of forward movement. "Could you please stop calling me Nats?"
"Geez, what do you want me to call you? Natsy or spy like them others do?"
Mavis managed to look as though I had just spit upon her grandmother's grave.
"Well, if it's all the same to you, you could call me Patty or even the name I was born with, Patricia."
Mavis looked a long way from being convinced, so I added,
"I don't call you thief, do I?"
In the cafeteria line, Mavis stood in front of me as rigidly silent as the angel on the topmost point of the room's Christmas tree.
"Don't they know that Christmas trees are supposed to be taken down as soon as Christmas is over?" I asked. "Can't go about taking a Christmas tree down on a Sunday," she said, sounding shocked at my ignorance. "Wouldn't be right."
I was grateful that she was still talking to me. "No, guess not," I answered. As Mavis wiped the last crumbs from her plate with a piece of white bread, I saw her eyes check my plate.
"I haven't touched my eggs," I said,
pushing my plate towards her and wondering why the eggs didn't taste as powdery to her as they did to me. Mavis scraped them onto her plate, then paused with her fork directly over my mound of grits. Her eyes sought my permission.
"I'm all finished eating," I said. "You ain't much of an eater, is you?" she said, and then added in lieu of thanks, "Patty."
After breakfast, the day room, with its hard-backed chairs lined like soldiers against the wall, was empty. The girls had all gone over to the non-denominational services in the chapel. On my first Sunday here, I had gone because the head matron, Miss Laud, secretly called Miss Bald due to the fact that pink skin was beginning to show through her hair, kept emphasizing that the services were absolutely non-denominational. Now maybe, and I'll give her the benefit of the doubt, the services are non-denominational for Baptists, Methodists, and Jehovah's Witnesses, but they are definitely not non-denominational for a Jewish girl. I say this because the minister spent just about his whole sermon talking about the method the Jews used when they killed Jesus. The clock high above the doorway of the day room read 10 till 10, yet the grayness of the morning hung on. On the side table sat the room's most valuable item, a mahogany radio with an arched top. Usually it was a blare with sad-sounding cowboys singing of girls they had loved and lost, but for the time being it sat quietly neglected. I snapped the knob to the right and waited for the tubes to warm. I tried to find something good to listen to on a Sunday morning. Phil Baker and his $64 question wasn't till evening, and so was Baby Snooks. Even Andre Kostolanitz and his orchestra wasn't till later.
"For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that..."
I moved the dial, this time to singing.
"Where he leads me, I shall follow..."
And another turn of the dial.
"Tell me why it is, dear friends," cried out a man's voice in apparent anguish, "that people will believe the promise of a bank. Give us your money, we'll keep it safe. And they'll believe the promise of a boss. Work for me, and I'll give you money. Then why is it that these same people have trouble believing in the greatest promise ever given to mankind? Jesus made that promise to you, and he made it to me. And this was his promise: whosoever believeth in me shall be given life everlasting."
I snapped the knob to the left, and except for the steady hissing of the radiator, the room was silent. Back in my room, the thick Sunday edition of the Memphis Commercial Appeal, a gift subscription from Charlene Madley, lay on my bed. It was nice having a lady like that for a friend. And I liked having my very own newspaper subscription. I mean, besides reading it, it was nice in another way, too. It was the something good, instead of always the something bad, that set me apart. I wasn't like them, like the others, and the paper was proof of that. After my trial, Charlene Madley was the only reporter, and the courtroom was filled with them, who came over to say she was sorry.
And she was, too. I caught a look on her face of genuine distress. On my second day at Bolton, I received her first note. I read it so many times that it became engraved on my brain. "Patty, I'm sending you a subscription to my paper with the hope that you will enjoy reading it. Keep smiling. Charlene Madley." And in each reading of Charlene's note, I scoured her words for the gift of friendship. Sometimes, like an optical illusion, I found it, and other times I didn't. Anyway, I wrote Charlene back, thanking her and saying the thing I liked most to read were the stories that carried her byline. That wasn't hard to say. People like honest compliments, I know that. It was what I said next that made me hesitate because it sounded presumptuous. I still think I'd like to study to become some kind of reporter or writer someday. But she didn't think I was just a presumptuous kid, because she wrote me right back a whole page. Footsteps. Determined footsteps came echoing down the corridor. Miss Laud? What would she want me for? I'm not breaking any rules. No cigarettes, no shoes on the bed, door open. About the non-denominational services? But I've already explained that, how the services go against my beliefs. I won't go. As the footsteps stopped at my door, fear took hold. I forced myself to look up at the full standing authority of Miss Evelyn Laud.
"You know a nigra named Ruth Hughes?"
"Ma'am?"
"A nigra named Ruth Hughes says she's your nanny, that right?"
Yes, ma'am, that's right." Miss Laud nodded.
"Well, go on down to the visitor's room and see her."
"Ma'am?" I asked, like one who has suddenly stopped understanding the English language.
"Well, go down and see her," repeated Miss Laud in tones loud enough for the deaf.
Through the open archway of the visitor's room, I could see Ruth, her back towards me, looking out the mesh-covered window to the courtyard below. She was wearing a dress I had never seen before, deep blue like the sky gets toward evening. It looked to be crepe, and good enough not only for Sunday, but for Easter Sunday as well. Strange. She didn't seem to hear my approach, for her gaze never strayed from the window. "Ruth?" Like a spring suddenly released, she turned, her brown face showing a wide, welcoming smile. But it wasn't the smile that caught me quite as much as her eyes. They had this shine, a gloss that I remembered seeing once before, but I couldn't quite remember when. Arms circled me, bringing me close.
"Patty, honey babe, how you doing?"
A fragrance of bath powder scented gardenia.
"You doing all right, honey?"
My head found its resting place next to her shoulder, and I closed my eyes while I silently prayed for the world to go away.
"Are they treating you all right here?"
I nodded my head yes, but I didn't know for sure whether she got my message, so I said, "I guess they are. Yes." And there in the protection of her circle, I felt freshly born. Ruth, still with an arm around my waist, led me to a wooden bench next to the radiator. But before we sat down, she pushed me an arm's length away and gave me a careful looking over.
"You sure ain't doing no overeating hereabouts, are you?"
"On Sundays we have scrambled eggs for breakfast," I said, wondering if my answer fit the question.
There's 6 other days need accounting for.
Well, mostly they serve grits for breakfast.